All right, hi everybody, and welcome to lecture 33 in this ancient history program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We are beginning part 3 of the course today, and I'm entitling that part and this lecture, A New Beginning. So we are going to start into that part of history which we designate as classical. So we're going to move past a level of development on which human beings were stuck for certainly the first half of all of recorded human history, but truthfully were in many regards stuck on well into what we would call modern times, to varying degrees, and where absolutely and unequivocally many people are still stuck today in their own mindset, as illustrated by the barbarism of events in Paris over the weekend. So, human life is a pretty delicate proposition. Archaism is alive and well right now. There's nothing that says that all of the wonderful things that we have in modern society are necessary, or permanent or guaranteed in any sense. They are achievements. The beauty, the wonder of modern life is a profound achievement, and it is, in some regards, quite recent, quite rare, quite exceptional, though in others, still rare, but in some cases, actually quite old, surprisingly old, and that's where we get the concept classical. Our world, this world that we have around us, is a fascinating combination of various threads of human development, and the oldest living components of our society and of our way of life we refer to as classical. They're ancient, like the archaic things that we have encountered, but they still have this vitality, they still have this quality of being a part of the life that we lead now. They are still there. They are still embedded in the way that we live today. So that we need a concept for, right? That's why we differentiate between things that are archaic and things that are classical. And the big question that arises is, how come there are these different types of history? How did we get here, and by what means, and how did human beings do that? Because at this level that we have been studying so far, human beings were thoroughly stuck. I think that's about the best word for it. They were stuck. They had climbed out of prehistoric darkness. That at least they had done. Right? So there were things that they had achieved, and we should enumerate those and we should think about those because they are significant, and the people that did it deserve credit, and we need to understand those things that human beings have learned to do, that were beneficial and that were positive about this plateau that they were on, this archaic level of development that they had reached. But then on the other hand, we have to ask some really deep probing questions about what it is that was missing and what it is that underlies the progress that makes our world possible. What are the ingredients of a modern life as opposed to an archaic life? What do people have to learn to do? And what is it, consequently, that we need to learn to embrace and to sustain as people who want to keep that, people who don't want to go back to an archaic way of life, despite the fact that some people today thoroughly would choose that for us and impose it on us if they could. We don't want that. We want to live in the best world possible. And so how do we do that? How it's not automatic. We certainly have a perception. It's very common in modern society to take pretty much everything for granted. That is definitely a very dangerous perspective that is common. But history is meant to be, is in part as an antidote to that. History is meant to help you be the kind of person that looks at the world around you and appreciates it. Remember how we talked about that term? How we talked about the idea that appreciation means the value of something goes up. Most people walk around today and it's shocking the way that they conceive of the world as being this terrible place and where everything is rotten and they complain about everything, you know, on social media. Talk about a hilarious irony, right? That they have this technology, this communication technology and all this in this information age of ours, and they can't see the wonder of that. All they can see is stuff that's rotten and they just don't appreciate it. They can't seem to have the thoughts that are required in order to truly, properly enjoy the values that are present. Which doesn't mean there aren't things that need fixing or improving, right? But there's a really fundamental perspective that is really lacking in a lot of people, especially a lot of young people today, but just people in general. It's just they just don't appreciate how amazing the world is that we live in right now. And history is part of the proper purpose of history is to fix that, to knock people out of their complacency and their presumptions and all of their, you know, their nowadays, what's that word for that mentality that people have, that entitled mentality that people have? It's just sickening the way that people are so entitled and they feel like the world owes them everything and they're so disappointed in the world all the time. And that is just a horrible way to go through life. I hope that you don't fall into that trap, but it's all too common nowadays. And consequently, everybody kind of walking around disappointed in everything that they see. So we have an amazing life and it's as good as it's ever been. So that is something, to marvel at and to feel very thankful for and to identify the causes of and to honor and to act to sustain because it didn't come cheap. So let's honor that. Let's figure that out. And by looking at history. So this is for me, the exciting part about studying what we are going to study now, this new beginning, is that this is where it comes from. This is where we're really going to see some steps being taken by human beings for the first time to transform the archaic way of life into the far superior modern way of life that we enjoy. All right, so hopefully that's motivating to you, that you will see here that the story of history is not, this is going to be easier to connect to the life that we lead and to the world around us. Hopefully that will be motivating in terms of understanding it, but also hopefully it will be motivating in terms of the fact that it will help us to appreciate the values that we have in the life that we live. So let's, before we leap into this new, you know, this new beginning here, what I want to do is I want to summarize and collect together kind of in really broad strokes, the basic meaning of what we have seen so far. I want to articulate an idea or concept that represents everything that we've seen so that we can wield it in the most useful form possible. And so the term that I want to use to describe what we have seen so far and to integrate kind of all of the various components of what we've been studying is the following. I'm going to type it into the chat box. Okay. I'm going to call what we have studied so far the Archaic Plateau. The Archaic Level of Development. Right, this word plateau, are you guys familiar with it, or is it the first time you've heard it before? Never heard it before, or easy word? Which one is it? Theo, you walk around using the word plateau all the time?
Well, I know what plateau means, but I haven't heard that specific phrase before.
Okay, so yeah, I wouldn't expect you to have heard that usage before. I just want to know if you're familiar with the word plateau. In what context would you normally expect to hear the word plateau, Theo?
Well, like near the Grand Canyon.
Okay, that's an interesting one, right? In terms of just physical geography, right? I was thinking of something similar to make sure that everybody kind of grasped the idea. It's kind of a term pertaining to what we call terrain or the topology of the earth, kind of, right? Just physical terrain. Here's just, if you just look at this yellow illustration, I don't know anything about this other thing, but just look at this yellow illustration here, it's kind of useful, right? If you're climbing Mount Everest, the tallest mountain in the world, right? Isn't it nice that you could kind of go up this way, rather than go up this way, which is pretty much all really straight up and hard to do, you could go up this way and then you could stop here. Right, which is this flat area where you can rest and where you can kind of get, you know, stage the next phase of your ascent or whatever, right? And, you know, I'm no expert in mountain climbing or anything like that. But the basic point here that I'm trying to relate, I think, still will hold, even if anything I say about mountain climbing is ludicrous. But basically, you know, this would be what we call a plateau. And what you're talking about there, Theo, in terms of a plateau as well, kind of a flat area, kind of the opposite, right? Because then you have this huge gorge carved out by, it's the Colorado River, right? And it's, you know, then you got these different levels going down until you get to the bottom of the canyon. And so you've got these various plateaus. So whether you're climbing up or climbing up Mount Everest, or you're climbing down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon, you're going to reach various plateaus, and those are useful, right? And so that's kind of the physical meaning of it. And by extension, though, people talk about plateaus in terms of personal development or social or kind of also development in terms of societies or civilizations. So what we mean by that is kind of a certain level that you reach in terms of what you do, how you live. Okay, and that is my usage here, right? That is my more specific usage in using the phrase the archaic plateau. What I mean is that there is a distinctive level of development that people reached, and then history kind of flattened out there. They climbed up out of prehistorical darkness and then achieved a certain number of things, and their life came to be characterized by certain features. And then, well, that's it. You know, this is kind of like this. This is prehistorical darkness, and they climbed up, and they got to this level, and this is the archaic plateau. And then, okay, and since then, we've climbed and climbed and climbed, okay, and done other things, right? But there was a certain level of development that people reached, and that's as far as they got for a long time. And as I said, in many regards, there are people today whose mentality is is thoroughly archaic still. So that's pretty troubling, because it means that they have not been able to elevate their thinking to match the wonders of modern life. And that is really sickening. So what do they do because of their archaic mindset? They'll get inside of an airplane, and instead of flying to another place to enjoy life, what will they do? They'll fly the airplane into a building and kill people. So that's, you know, that's a really kind of potent symbolic example, right? The events of 9/11 and more recent terrorist attacks and so on is kind of, that's an archaic mindset in a modern context, and how thoroughly disturbing and dangerous that is, right? So these are important ideas. And so let's talk about this archaic plateau and what it was. And we can look at it from a number of different angles, but I mainly want to look at it in terms of what were the positives, but not exclusively, but also what were the primary features of it. So let's enumerate these things here and talk about this plateau that we've been looking at. So first of all, what is it that fundamentally separates the people who reach this archaic plateau from those who are not even there, like who are even at a lower level? So low that we don't know anything about them. What am I referring to here that is one of those features that at least is one of those things that human beings learned to do that elevated their existence beyond prehistoric primitivism? Juliet?
They wrote stuff down.
They learn how to write. Yeah, exactly. So we can imagine primitive human beings, and if we look at so-called Native Americans and stuff like that, I mean, they had language, right? They could speak to each other. They could use concepts and so on, but they didn't have writing. So that was really a debilitating limitation on what they could achieve. And human beings that don't have writing basically just never become historically significant. Only those that develop writing ever rise up to that archaic plateau. So it's not surprisingly, who are the first, civilizations that we see? Well, they're the first ones to develop writing. Egypt, Mesopotamia, definitely among the first societies ever to develop writing. India probably a little bit later as well, and China later as well. And these are the cradles of civilization, so-called. And these are the first peoples, the first societies where writing developed. And so from then on, we have some ability, because they wrote stuff down, then they're able to create a permanent record of their activities and learn from that record. And we ourselves, looking back upon them, can do the same. Okay, so writing is one of those components. Okay, good. All right, what else? What else do we see that is so characteristic of life in these archaic societies? We could say that it is symbolized in part by this, right, that we previously looked at, or alternatively, it's not quite as dramatic, but here again, if we look at these, tendrils passing through the desert, we see the same phenomenon. And then down here, we have these greener areas leading all the way down to the Persian Gulf, because this is what we call Mesopotamia, right? So we're getting just a superior place for human beings to live. What is this other feature of archaic life that this setting makes possible, Keen?
Well, the people, they settled down in a place that can support agriculture.
Okay, right, yeah. Agriculture, sedentary life and agriculture. I mean, not sedentary in the sense of sitting on the couch, right? But at least being settlement and agriculture would be these other features that go hand in hand with stabilizing human life to the point where anybody can sit down and learn how to write. I mean, because basically at that archaic level, the big priority that continues to dominate human life is what? Big difference between modern and archaic. Not so much between classical and archaic, because this held to be, this, you know, continued to be true in classical civilizations, but it's not, it's no longer true in modern civilization. So what's this huge overriding priority, Theo?
Well, trying to survive, like get food and water.
Exactly. Stuff. To have enough of the basic necessities, the cardinal values to support human life, namely food and water, but as well shelter. I mean, you're way better off if you can, if you're going to have a shelter, to have it in one place because you can develop it significantly and waterproof it and do all those other things. And of course, that goes hand in hand with agriculture, because you got to settle down and you got to learn to plant your own food. So you got to produce these crucial values that human beings need in order to survive. So that's part of this archaic level of development, is that human beings have found a basic solution to these really pressing human needs that we have. And they did it, as I think Keane was mentioning, basically by finding these, one of these geographical sweet spots, one of these really great locations where nature makes it as easy as possible for us to do that, right? So this is one of them here that we're looking at, Mesopotamia. And then we saw earlier, right, we saw ancient Egypt because of the Nile. And then if you look in India, you have the Indus and the Ganges River. And then in China, you have the Yangtze and the Yellow Rivers. Everywhere you look, the cradles of civilization are the river valleys. Those are the places where civilization begins, because human beings don't have the ability yet, at the archaic plateau, they don't yet have the ability, or they have a very, very limited ability to command nature. Right? I mean, that modern life is radically different on that score. Right? So, it doesn't matter how hot or cold it is outside, right? In modern life, depending on how terrible Mother Nature is being to us at any particular moment, you flick the thermostat and the problem is solved. Wow. Well, talk about command, right, over nature. And if you, and you can extend that thought to virtually any area, you know, very, any aspect of human life. Modern life is characterized by this ability to command nature, right? We understand the various physical truths by means of physical science. We understand things like gravity, electromagnetism, and so on and so forth, right? On genetics and other marvels of modern science and medicine and technology and so on. And so we can do things that are just absolutely staggering, right? Including sitting down in a nice, comfortable chair and flying through the sky. Or getting in a still relatively comfortable little room and being thrust in a rocket up into space. And stuff like that, right? This is now normal, right? And Rosie, yeah, watching TV or using the internet or in any of those things that, you know, are so very much taken for granted by people today are just absolutely shockingly marvelous, are they not? Because here I am speaking, and my voice would normally carry only within the walls of this room. But I don't have to deal with that limitation that nature has imposed on me. Thanks to people like Thomas Edison and others like him, there is a way to transfer the signal, the audio signal of my voice, into an electronic form to transmit that at the speed of light around the world, and for you all to hear that, which is just, you know, a godlike power, truly, right? If Egyptians were to, you know, conceive of this, it would be, well, they simply couldn't. right? Because they're stuck on this, like I said, that key word is stuck on this archaic plateau. And on this plateau, there's no significant science or technology. I mean, there's not none, because human beings do gradually learn how to work metals, for instance. They develop iron, and then they develop steel, and we have these different ages at you know, primitive stages and so on. And they learn to use the wheel in different societies at different times, and so on, right? So there are kinds of technology, really, really basic. Even before that, right, they learn to tame fire and do stuff like that. So there's so many small steps that we take, but nonetheless, there's really, compared to modern life, there's no significant science or technology in archaic societies. And so that's another feature, right? There is writing, and there is agriculture, primitive agriculture, and settlement. Those are all features of archaic life, but really it's very only the most limited forms of science and technology exist. There's really no science, but there is kind of a very basic kind of technology that human beings are developing, but it's really, really so little that that's part of the story here. And one of the reasons why there's so little technology is that human beings at the archaic plateau don't think that they can actually do anything with nature. They don't actually think that they can even understand nature. Because what do they think about the natural world? Another characteristic feature of the culture of people at the archaic plateau. What do they think about the natural world? Such as the Nile. The Nile is a part of the natural world. Every year it floods. Okay, there's a pattern to that. All right, keep going. What do they think about that? What is their interpretation of these phenomena? Abby?
Well, they think that the gods that they believe in cause it.
Okay, right. So they believe that the natural world is controlled by the supernatural world. Okay, so this is one of the dominant premises that they have that, well, really keeps them stuck at that level. They can't understand the world because the explanation for anything is there's a god doing it. So does the Nile flood? Yes. Okay, why? Oh, because the gods did that. In Mesopotamia, right? One city defeats another. Well, was that because the general was really adept at organizing his army? No, why was that? Abby?
The gods wanted that particular city to win.
Yeah, one of the gods of that city, let's say the god of Babylon, Marduk, right, granted Babylon the victory. He defeated. He was dueling with the other god of whatever city was conquered, and he beat that god. So the Babylonians won the war. Okay, so in other words, how do you develop a scientific outlook in the world if the world is full of gods? We'll talk about the Greeks and their interpretation of this mindset here. And how they move past this. But basically, in the archaic mindset, everything is to be explained. That, I'm using that word very loosely. But it's to be explained by reference to supernatural forces. And those are really inaccessible. Nobody knows them or can understand them. But they are somehow adapted to that. Human beings develop various types of religion in relation to that. So the Egyptians have their various gods, their various beliefs of how the natural world runs. The Mesopotamians have their various gods and their various beliefs as to how their world makes any sense to them. Okay, so they develop this highly religious and very superstitious would be another way to kind of characterize that perspective that says, explain anything by virtue of a supernatural answer. That's the only answer. So then you can't really delve into nature and study it scientifically, because you basically don't have any motivation to do that. Because the answer, as far as you understand, really isn't accessible. It's in another dimension altogether. It's this world of the gods. So at the Archaic Plateau, you don't have science and technology. You have this pervasive superstition where everything is explained in terms of the supernatural. Okay. So, what else? We're close here. We're closing in on a pretty comprehensive kind of enumeration of the various features. What about, you know, what is that other pervasive thing that we see in terms of how social life is structured? And how, you know, people living in collections of human beings, right, in societies, what do we see wherever we look in archaic societies? King?
Different classes of people?
Yeah, okay, that's a feature of a basic kind of way of organizing society, which culminates in something in particular, right? The most dominant feature, represented by the pyramids, represented by the ziggurats, right? The thing that leaps out at you. What do we see, Theo?
Monarchs.
Yeah, we see people who are ruling everybody else. And yeah, we can articulate that in a variety of ways. And you know, no monarch, no pharaoh, no Patesi, no Lugal, no anybody, Persian emperor, doesn't matter what, right, rules single-handedly. We know that. There's always a supporting cast. But it is, nonetheless, a very hierarchical society. Keen, your point about caste is good in the sense that societies are extremely hierarchical, but they're also very flat in the sense that, you know, 99% of people are just basically trying to get along, pardon me, and grow food and just make it through life. Just make it. Then meanwhile, this small percentage of people operates as part of a ruling class, and their world revolves around a monarch, a pharaoh, or an emperor, or what have you. Okay, so that is another feature of this archaic plateau, is that societies are organized under rulers. And we see that the relationships between human beings, politically speaking, are not benevolent relationships. There's no individual rights, to state the matter negatively, right? What we'd say is, we don't see any individual rights. What we see is the idea that human beings need to organize their societies in such a way that some people are in charge of others. Who's it going to be? Right? I mean, the answers vary and so on. But pretty much what we see is that those who are stronger, right, end up taking over. So if you want to articulate that as a theory of rights, you could say might makes right. That's very archaic, right? The most powerful characters rule. So if you are a vizier, you're not the pharaoh, but you know what? Society has fallen apart and you're quite adept at organizing your particular clique, then, you know, might makes right. Montuhotep II. You could become the pharaoh too. On the other hand, right, the whole age of pyramids is governed by another archaic construct. There's really pretty much two at the archaic level. The reality is might makes right, but then every once in a while people overlay this nice little shiny extra stuff on top of that. And we call that Theo?
Well, it's
that the pharaoh is the god king. The pharaoh is the representative of the gods. So what do we call that?
Dang, I totally forgot.
What kind of right does he have to rule?
Divine right.
Divine right. Perfect, right? That other archaic notion. that says that some people are more connected to the gods than everybody else, and therefore they have a divine right to rule. Notice that this one lasted a long time too, and it's still there in some barbaric segments of the world's population today. But, you know, in European societies, it began to die, you know, first of all, in England, but then, of course, America, and then with the French Revolution, and gradually it died off. But look how recent that is. Even that archaic concept has been with us all the way, and well into, you know, even 100 years ago in recognizably important countries in the world, there was still divine right. The Russian monarchy was finally brought to an end. It was a divine right monarchy. It was brought to an end in 1917. That's less than 100 years ago, there was still divine right in a really important part of the world. Never mind that there was still divine right in Japan. Until when? Staggering to think about it. When did divine right end in Japan? Theo?
The 1800s, right?
No. Well. Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That's when it ended. The Emperor of Japan was the one for whom the kamikazes were sacrificing their life. And so it ended with two nuclear flashes and the imposition of a constitution on Japan by the United States. Wow, that's 1945. Divine right was still around. So that's what I mean by how you know, delicate and fragile modern society is. Wait, you think you live in some kind of advanced and benevolent, you know, modern human life? Wait a minute. Archaism is... Look how pervasive it is in human life. It is shocking. It should be scary. And because there are still people all over the world that would tell you that they understand the supernatural better than you, and therefore they should rule you. So, that's another really crucial feature of archaic human life. We have might makes right, and we have divine right, but what we don't have is individual rights. So there, take those various features here. We enumerate those, and that is the archaic plateau. Okay, that's human life. Improved only to a certain point. A human life that has gotten, you know, further than that really awful prehistoric primitivism that was the prior stage, but still only gets you to a certain point. So how do we get from primitive, superstitious, brutal, archaic life to wonderful, advanced, scientific, free, modern human life? How did that happen? Remember what I just said? Japan had divine right monarchy until 1945. Whoa, 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 whoa. How long have we been doing this right? And where and since when? How stable is that in human life? This is not an academic question here, right? I mean, this is serious, because if you don't understand some of these issues, you put yourself in some serious danger. Because, I mean, really, this past weekend, what happened? Which will seriously affect your life. Just one more step in just this really disturbing phenomenon that continues to characterize modern life now. What happened? I hope you guys know. Juliet?
Terrorists went, well, there were a few attacks, but basically terrorists went into just events that were happening. There was a baseball game or something, and they were at a stadium, and they just opened fire on the crowd, and there was a theater, and they held hostages and killed them one by one. It was terrible.
Mm-hmm. Right. There were terrorist attacks. Okay, now, who claimed responsibility for that? And who do we know is responsible for that? Well, there's a group in the world called ISIS right here on the map, right here. Right? In this area that we call Syria today and Iraq and so on. And, well, what is their mindset? Right? They are waging a civil war in their own country, which has thrust, I don't know how many people, but some maybe a million people out of there. And they're refugees, and these civilized people of Europe feel bad for them, are trying to accommodate them. But what's happening at the same time? These archaic people are sneaking in along with the rest. And what do they want to do? They want to kill everybody that doesn't agree with them. And so we know that one of the people involved, and we'll find out that more and more of the details will come through, that these are people that came into civilization for only one purpose, to kill other people, to destroy civilization. That's what they want to do. In the name of, you know, whatever religious code that they have that is absolutely intolerant of everything else in the universe. And it's scary because, yes, there was an American that died in those attacks. So if you think that you're immune to these things, well, you know, 9/11, maybe you guys weren't around and it doesn't really scar you and it doesn't really feel too real to you yet. And maybe the Boston bombings weren't that real to you. Maybe they were far away from you. Or, you know, maybe the various things that have been going on in the United States, which are downplayed by the media, have just been kind of, you know, slip by, and you haven't noticed that they're there, but they're there, and it's pretty scary, and it's going to get worse. So this is a very real problem, very present, relevant, very life and death, understanding this type of, you know, meaningful topic in human life. How do we get to keep this stuff that we have? How do we get to keep this amazing, wonderful, benevolent, and free society that we live in? It's the rarest, most beautiful thing that there is. How do we get to keep it? And not fall victim to the archaism that is prevalent in human history. So, Keen, go ahead. What's your comment?
I was going to answer your question, but it was more rhetorical, I guess.
No, go ahead. What's your answer?
Well, I was going to say study history.
Yes, that's definitely one of the answers. Of course, that is the answer that I personally believe needs to be, you know, promoted in our culture, that this is not an answer that anybody has nowadays, and that's part of our problem. And thus, if we can revive and to some extent reinvent history, because it needs it desperately, that we can strengthen our hold on this advance that is so precious. Without it, yeah, we're definitely in trouble. There are a lot of things that are very troubling in modern times, and you know, I don't know how serious things can get. And fortunately, civilizations like the United States are incredibly resilient compared to others. That's part of one of the wonderful things about modern life, is that is that these advanced countries in Western civilization are, it's true, it's amazing. They're incredibly resilient. So it will be hard, and people will die and will be mourned in Paris, and there will be others to follow and so on, and it will be hard. But the thing is, that won't destroy these cultures. That's these archaic people can't do that yet. Thank God. They just can't. They don't have the hold of nuclear weapons yet. So that is, you know, still, but it's definitely a challenging topic. So that to me is the power of this thing that we're going to see now. We are going to see the first steps out of archaism. It's amazing. It's so beautiful a sight. It really is so deeply moving to me when I see this part of history. The people that are going to do this, they're going to propel us to a new way of life. And they get absolutely and singularly the credit. These are the ones. Okay, there's nobody else. Ever. These are the ones that did it. It was the Greeks. The ancient Greeks. Nothing that is so precious about modern life today would ever exist were it not for the ancient Greeks. So this is where it's at. This is exciting. It's ancient, but it's not archaic. It's classical. And beyond that, we need a whole other word for the Greeks. It's indispensable. It is fundamental. We don't have a word for this. Maybe we need a new one. We need what's called a neologism. We need a new concept to capture what the Greeks were. Because there's nothing like it. They were, as we're going to see, archaic people at first. To a considerable extent, may continue to be archaic. So that means that they were primitive, they were superstitious, and they were brutal, just like everybody else. So we're not going to expect people to start walking around, in a whole new civilized way. Don't expect to see that in your study of in our coming study of ancient Greece. But you will nonetheless see something that is spectacular. You will see that the Greeks refused to accept that all these things that we have said about archaism, they refused to accept that as good enough. They refused to accept that that was the defining nature of human life. They wanted another definition of human. That, in essence, is what the Greeks did. They changed, this is what we're going to talk about tomorrow, they changed the meaning of the word human. And if we can look at the terrorists and we can really, you know, we can condemn those terrorist attacks as inhuman, that's because we have some part of that insight that the Greeks have given us of what human means. It's not that archaic definition. That isn't good enough. We have another way of looking at it. Now, it varies. And as a way to close today's lecture, I would invite you to introspect. What is your understanding of what it means to be human? That's a pretty deep topic. That's a very philosophical topic. Okay, the thinking about human nature. Right? But here's the thing. It's non-optional. Children get to, play and enjoy life and not have to be too deep about it all and just, that's being a child. It's nice. But the thing is, you guys now aren't children anymore. This is not This isn't a class for children. So you have to be invited. You have to be challenged to start asking questions and challenging yourself to look at the world and look at yourself and look at other people and figure it out. So you need to ask questions like this. You need to be a person that investigates this topic. What does it mean to be human? And studying history is just a great avenue for doing that, in a sense, because I'll show you. We know what the archaic people thought the answer to that question was. Now I'm going to show you what the Greeks figured out about that other people didn't understand. And then you have an opportunity then to examine and explore your own thoughts and maybe be more observant about other people as well around you and what their thoughts are about this subject. And, you know, think about that and challenge that, because what I would say about people today is they don't often think about these things. They tend to be pretty unconscious. They tend to just go through the motions. Remember, we were talking about tests and jumping through hoops and the regular way of doing history and so on. And consequently, the answers that people have about a lot of these questions are not very good, not very satisfying. I don't know about the people around you, and I don't know about you personally and so on, how good your answers are and so on. I'm not saying that that's true of you, but I am saying of the culture that you live in, it's quite generally the case. The answers are not very impressive. So that creates a special responsibility for you as an individual. You live in such a wonderful time, but you also live in a culture that has a lot of problems. So it's time to get busy growing up and figuring out the world and acting in it in a more mature, independent manner. Hopefully you can have the best life you can have if you can succeed in these things. So, I'm looking forward to this. So, the Greeks tomorrow, we're going to talk about what was the Greek definition of human. What was it that they were able to see about human life that helped them to push past the archaic plateau? They did it. And it wasn't by accident. They figured it out. So, we'll go see what it was that they did. All right, guys. Looking forward to it. Thank you. Talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks for class, Mr. Bell. Bye. Have a nice day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.